I'm happy to introduce myself, Candace, and it's great to work with you again. My name is Cynthia. I'm an academic, I'm an activist, and I'm a trade unionist.
Recently spoke on the topic of the erosion of academic freedom at Ryerson University alongside Andrea Smith. What was your talk about?
Yes, I was very happy to speak at Ryerson on the evening of January 21st because Ryerson colleagues have been involved in some very interesting debates about academic freedom. And those are debates and conversations that also have an international development or dimension in the sense that while academic freedom has been an important issue for people in the university sector, obviously, for decades, I think it's fair to say that there's been a really renewed interest in rethinking the question of academic freedom because of renewed threats in the wake of post-September 11th, firing of high-profile academics such as, for example, Norm Finkelstein in the U.S., debates about campus activism around Palestine, the way in which neoliberalism is massively restructuring our universities, skyrocketing fees, and much more have all, I think, renewed the desire among academics to rethink and reposition politics around academic freedom.
And what was your contribution to that argument?
Well, as you noted, I was part of a panel which also featured Maria Wallace, also from York University, and the very well-known Indigenous academic Andrea Smith, who's influenced many, many people on a host of questions. What I was specifically asked to speak about by Ryerson colleagues was the whole question of what have been some major attacks on academic freedom in the Canadian context recently. And in order to get at that question, one of the things that I felt that I had to do was to argue that the whole concept of academic freedom maybe needed to be rethought, that in some ways it's not doing the work that it needs to be doing, and that in order to understand why it's not doing that work for us, we needed to understand historically how the concept of academic freedom actually developed. So a good part of my talk was looking at the history of the concept and then comparing that history with some actual cases today to figure out why the concept wasn't in practice helping a number of people who were finding themselves in difficult contexts in their colleges and universities. And then I concluded the talk by making some suggestions for change, both at the level of how we think about academic freedom, but also some strategic suggestions about political work people could do.
So the concept of academic freedom, what are its historical roots?
Well, one of the things I argued is that most people conceptualize today academic freedom as some kind of variant on freedom of speech or freedom of expression, right? They tend to think of it as the academic variation of freedom of speech or freedom of expression. So what I argued is that historically, that's actually not the way that it developed or that it's useful to think about it that way. I argued that it's closer to think of, it's better to think about it as linked to guild regulation. It arose historically in a particular kind of moment, and it involved the kind of trade-off in which professional academics agreed that they would be professional in certain kinds of ways in exchange for limited forms of academic freedom, right? It rested on the assumption, for example, that you would have a faculty that is full-time tenured professoriate, which of course is now been substantially changed all across North America, right? With greater numbers of contract people who simply don't have those kind of basic academic freedom protections. It also assumed that people would uphold particular kinds of professional norms, but for many insurgent academics today, and Andrea Smith, her own work is on this, and she spoke about this quite well in her own talk, a lot of critical academics, one of the first things they want to do actually is re-examine the professional norms that organize their disciplines, right? And disciplinary boundaries and assumptions about knowledge production, assumptions about pedagogy, right? Another kind of assumption that's often undergirded academic freedom is that you would use your expression to make commentary in areas only of your expertise, right? Which poses a dilemma for critical insurgent academics. I can think of figures like Andy Smith, for example, or like Noam Chomsky, who, in addition to commenting in areas of their own professional expertise, also function as public intellectuals to make critical interventions on a host of issues of the day. So what I'm pointing to, and there's more than we have space for in this radio show that undergirds the concept of academic freedom, but what I'm basically suggesting is that it was limited from the start to a particular notion of professional speech that really doesn't do the kind of work that we need to have now in terms of thinking through what does freedom of speech mean, for example, when you take it off the campus, or do contract faculty have freedom of speech, or how wide is that freedom of speech? So those are all the kind of questions and more that I explored in my talk.
Yeah, maybe we could talk a little bit more about the regulation of speech on campuses as related to the concept of academic freedom. You know, like, what are some of the specific cases around academic freedom on Canadian campuses? You know, I'm thinking here on the show we've reported on the banning of the Israeli Apartheid Week posters and so many similar types of events. So, like, what are some of the specific cases going on right now?
Well, really, there's a large number of them, and they refer to a large number of different kinds of issues, right? Issues linked to problems around the commercialization of research, through to the whole question of do contract faculty, in fact, have academic freedom? Do students have academic freedom? How far does it extend? But you've also referenced Israel Apartheid Week, and since we're on the eve of Israeli Apartheid Week, it might make sense to make some brief commentary there, because as many of your listeners will know, Israel Apartheid Week is now a global event with forums and films and music and much more a feature of these debates and discussions in dozens of cities around the world, including, of course, Toronto and many of the campuses in Toronto. Now, in the Southern Ontario University context, the posters advertising Israeli Apartheid Week have, in the case of, I think, at least four university administrations, run into considerable difficulty with them either being banned or removed or other kinds of interventions happening. So that's been a space for some conversation there. In other respects, though, two university administrations have sought to regulate speech on campus in relation to Palestine, particularly as campus Palestinian solidarity grows and deepens in response to the international boycott, divestment, and sanctions call coming from Palestinian civil society organizations. So some universities have then responded. Carleton is a good example. McMaster is another. And a Carleton University student, Ben Safer, has recently written an excellent article, by the way, on this whole question of how speech is being regulated through particular kinds of dialogue events staged between Muslim and Jewish students or Muslim and Jewish professors in some cases. And Ben Safer makes a really good argument to say that, first of all, to rewrite the story of what's going on in Palestine as some kind of species of Muslim-Jewish community relations problem misses the point of what's at stake in that conflict, for starters, right? He also argues that, of course, people are not opposed to dialogue and transformation and struggle, because that's what we do in a lot of our political movements with each other, right? But he says the particular way these dialogues get structured presumes too much right from the beginning about the nature of the conflict and the nature about what it will take to fundamentally transform it and to challenge racism and colonialism. So, in other words, some of the forms of regulation of speech that are happening on campus, it's not just in the form of, quote-unquote negative repression, but may take the form of trying to engender particular kinds of speech, but in ways that are really not helpful for deepening the analysis about what is actually happening in the context of Israel and Palestine.
Okay, so what are maybe the alternatives to conceptualizing academic freedom? Like, how can we take academic freedom and make it work for social justice movements?
It's a very good question, Candace, and it's also a tough one, because part of my argument is that the concept of academic freedom wasn't really designed to cover the speech of the very people who in many of our campuses are actually leading social change, right, or leading social justice conversations, for example, students, right? It's often on our campuses, it is students who are doing the most to raise the toughest questions and doing the tough organizing work. And then those of us as faculty may, you know, kind of fold in afterwards and kind of drag ourselves along. But it's often students doing that frontline work, right? And or contract faculty. And these are the same people who are not covered by these kinds of protections, right? So ultimately, I think we are going to have to deepen and extend radically the whole concept of academic freedom, or rethink whether that's a concept we want to use. But while we're doing that, I think there's a whole host of very practical things that people can do. I'll give you some examples of what has been going on and what is going on in the future that people might want to participate in. One important conversation that's been happening is conversations between and among those of us located in universities and those of us who are teaching in high schools and colleges, because those who are teaching in high schools and elementary schools and colleges really have no academic freedom. They just don't. And this was certainly an issue in the recent struggle in Ontario colleges, right? Because the whole question of the extent of their academic freedom was a big part of that recent labor dispute. So something practical I think we need to do is have more conversations with our colleagues in those settings about supporting each other. And also, there has been two recent conferences held in Toronto in the last couple of years that exactly looked at that issue of how to make alliances around extending freedom of expression there. A second kind of concrete thing people can do is simply come out to Israeli Apartheid Week and see for yourself the nature of the debate and education and dialogue and politics that's put forward there, right? Don't go by what you hear about it. You know, come and participate in those debates. And one of the things that's been an important feature of IAW has also been student-faculty alliances there in terms of moderating the event, in terms of follow-up where there is debate or campus repression. Another thing people can do is support No One Is Illegal's Education Not Deportation campaign, because certainly the capacity of students and non-citizen faculty also, for that matter, since some are on work permits, our capacity to participate politically also rests on our citizenship status. So if we fear deportation or detention or non-renewal of contracts if we are non-citizen workers, that affects, too, the extent of freedom of expression and freedom of speech. So it's a not unrelated issue. There's probably another important link here that I should mention is that we've been talking about academic freedom, which is obviously largely a concept that has been applied to the educational sector. But the other thing we need to look at is this is now a much broader issue. It's an off-campus issue in the sense that groups like the Canadian Arab Federation, Rights and Democracy, which is a human rights NGO out of Montreal, it's a well-known NGO, does international work. Kairos, which as many people know is a kind of alliance, it's a coalition of mainstream Christian groups in the country that does a variety of kind of social justice work. Many of these groups have been under severe attack for their alleged anti-Semitism, by which the federal government seems to mean their criticism of the Israeli state. Whether that's a strong criticism or a weak criticism or the nature of that criticism doesn't seem to matter to them. Any kind of criticism of the Israeli state and its militarism and settlement policies is seen as a form of anti-Semitism. And so the question of the regulation of speech then for me also is about the kind of public debate that we want to have about Palestine and about colonialism and apartheid, and it's one that's now far beyond the campus. So we need to be attentive to that and to think through alliances there. So maybe that's a good place to end for now.
Cynthia, thanks so much for your time. Do you have any final comments that you'd like to share with our listeners today?
Other than to say thank you, Candace, for having me on, and to encourage people to come out and be a part of the public conversation, education, and debate that is a part of Israel Apartheid Week.